Welcome to The Human Advantage, a podcast from the Center for Army Leadership, which explores the more personal and tactical applications of leadership. In each episode, we meet someone who's experienced the highs and lows of leading in situations ranging from major combat operations to challenges in barracks. We explore what they've learned about leadership to help our junior leaders prepare for success on operations today and in the future. I'm your host, Ash Bardwaj, a journalist and broadcaster and a British Army Reserve captain with the Rifles. In this episode, we learn how leading by example doesn't always require charging towards the enemy.
I asked the section commander to walk me around their accommodation and it was completely unacceptable. So I made it my mission for the first month to do everything I possibly could do to fix that accommodation problem. That built the trust, and from that point onwards, they absolutely opened up to me.
And how we can take good lessons from even bad examples of leadership.
We learn a lot from those hard times, and I think that was one of those watershed moments for me, whereby I understood the feeling of being made to feel so small and belittled, and I would never do that to anyone else.
Major David Love, commissioned into the Royal Military Police, the RMP, in 2007. He served on Op Herrick in Afghanistan and then moved to Permanent Joint Headquarters, PJHQ, to work as a staff officer on counterterrorism, rest of the world and Africa. This included deployments to Mali, Libya, Somalia, Djibouti, Uganda, Democratic Republic of Congo, South Sudan, Kenya and Bosnia. He deployed to Sudan on an RMP close protection tour before attending Staff College in 2016. After helping to rewrite RMP doctrine and special to arm training, he became Deputy Commandant of the Defence School of Policing and Guarding. In 2020, he was assigned as Force Provost Marshal to the United Nations Peacekeeping Force in Cyprus, before his current role as SO2 Leadership with the Centre for Army Leadership. I started by asking Dave what made him choose a career in the Royal Military Police.
I can remember the best bit of advice I was given at Sandhurst was your character will drive where you end up. And that's a really important point to remember, because if you end up somewhere where you're not personally aligned with those you're working with and for and leading, you will find it difficult. And there was something about the professionalism of the military police that really connected with my character. I'm a person that feels I have high personal integrity. I tend to always do the right thing when no one's looking. And I know that taking shortcuts only cheats myself. And I'll always choose the harder, more laborious route because I know I'll do a more thorough job. And I think that is a real character trait of where I ended up in the military police, in that they are highly professional. They really have to not just live by, but actually enforce the values and standards of the army upon the army and uphold them. So that really reflected my own personal character.
After Sandhurst, you went through phase two down in Portsmouth and then became a Royal Military Police officer. And then you went into a unit and took command. Can you explain what the role of the Royal Military Police is for people that don't know and how that applied on tour and in terms of what you had to do in a leadership role?
When you go through training at Sandhurst, you don't get exposure to a lot of military police. So there's a bit of a taboo about it. But when you sit down and you look at the varied career opportunities that the military police offer, it extends beyond what you'd see at face value. Yes, they police the force. They have to ensure adherence to law and service law. But they do a range of operational tasks, which are really important. And that was the case when I joined the military police, because we were in Afghanistan. It was new at the time. And we were doing counterinsurgency operations. And one of their primary roles in that situation is detainee and captured persons handling and guidance and support to deployed units. And that was a really hot topic at the time. You know, we'd just gone through Iraq. There were unfavorable situations in Iraq with Barham Moussa and Camp Breadbasket that really highlighted the importance of ensuring we were doing things correct.
And for people who don't know, those were two incidents of abuse and even the killing of a captive personnel by British forces. And so as you went into Afghanistan, it was a case of, for the Royal Military Police, ensuring that everybody in the British Army knew how to behave properly towards captured personnel. And if necessary, the Royal Military Police would enforce that proper behaviour.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. When we faced the public scrutiny coming out of Iraq, it was absolutely unacceptable. going into Iraq was the first time we'd done counterinsurgency operations in a long time. And we needed to learn the lessons from that and not make the same mistakes again in Afghanistan. So there's a real focus on the Geneva Conventions, proper detainee handling, captured persons handling, and what the army needed to do and what its responsibilities were. And the Royal Military Police's job was to ensure that that took place in the right way. Now, we also did other things. You know, you would still have to do garrison policing and normal general police duties, as you'd expect, as the police force of the army. So we were deployed in main base locations where people could drop in, report crimes or issues or thefts, you know. So we dealt with that as well. Those were the two primary functions. But there are a range of other things the military police do, like mobility support on land fighting operations. When a division or a corps goes out the door, the military police support and enable its movement. We do things like stability policing. Bosnia and Kosovo would be a great example where there are no functioning civil police force at the time. So you have to go in and try and bring back stability to a location that's been subject to conflict. And we also do security, things like close protection and convoy security and high value target protection, those sorts of things.
So it sounds like a very varied career. What was that like for you from a leadership perspective? Going into Afghanistan, were you just out there being a copper? What was the team like that you led?
When you work in the military police, you don't operate as functioning platoons like you would get elsewhere on operations. You have to look after sections that are quite dispersed, which brings challenges in its own right. So how do you command in a dispersed way? And a lot of that comes down to what you do pre-deployment. So gaining the trust and leading well beforehand so that you have that level of trust when you're communicating with your section commanders and they are doing the duties that they should do and you're used to how they operate. So you can command them effectively and lead them effectively. But my platoon was divided up between things like garrison policing and close support to, at the time it was 16 air assault brigades, so it was 2 para and 3 para who were deployed out on the ground. And I was based centrally within, at the time it was Kandahar and Camp Bastion. And the only time I got to see them was when they were coming back through on R&R, so rest and recuperation, which occurs during the course of the tour, or if I was to fly out to go and see them.
Looking back now on that experience, what were the methods of leadership that worked really well for you in terms of conversations, in terms of actions, or perhaps what you would do differently now that you have been through a career up to where you are now?
Yeah, it's a really good question because I arrived at my unit only 3 months out to deployment. So I finished phase 2 and I went straight into the unit and we had a cycle of policing, so normal garrison policing in Colchester, followed by the last cycle of training, which was just doing the final training for pre-deployment. And then we went on pre-deployment leave and then deployed. So actually the time to develop those leadership skills, it really in hindsight wasn't long enough. So I could only really apply what I knew out of Sandhurst and phase 2 training, which is largely command skills. It's receiving orders, it's giving orders, and it's a very mechanical way of dealing with people. It's very task orientated. And I know that is not leadership. Leadership is very human-centered. You've still got to achieve the task. But if you don't get the opportunity through your appointments to practice that human engagement, then you're missing a part of your responsibilities as a platoon commander. And I came back off of that operation having felt that I hadn't led as well as I could have. And it's taken me a long time. You know, I've now been in 18 years and I've learned a lot about leadership and I've had different appointments, which has helped me develop those skills. And it's a really good thing to say about leadership that you don't get it out of training. Training sets you up with the theory behind how you will grow and develop as a person, but it's definitely a through career endeavor.
So after Afghanistan, you came back to the UK, but then you were posted out to the training establishment down in Portsmouth. What was that like? And how did you apply yourself as a trainer there?
Again, it was one of those things where I hadn't developed the necessary human skills when I was assigned as platoon commander of a training school. And I went back to where I'd completed my phase 2 training only 18 months before. I took command of a training platoon and we took trainees going through military police training. There was a new platoon every 6 months.
So this was soldiers training to become Royal Military Policemen?
Yes, that's right. And I applied the standards I had been subject to, so the high standards of going through Sandhurst and the selection process and how difficult that was, and the high standards I had to meet as an officer. And I believed it was my responsibility as a platoon commander to protect standards of entry at all costs. And what that meant in reality was that I was, in reflection, way too ruthless in how I was dealing with trainees that were going through training. They weren't trained soldiers yet. They had no experience of the military police, but yet we were holding them to such high standards. So I made it a bit of a mission to try to deselect 50% of the trainees that were going through, thinking I was doing the military police some form of favor, which in reality was only preventing people from getting to the field army for what I recognize now, having gone back to the training school later on, was just mistakes that could have easily been remedied, whether that was just one of learning and performance. You know, maybe it was the person wasn't picking up the skills you were trying to teach them because they were neurodiversely different. And it's us that need to look inward to say, well, how would you then do something different to make sure that they do meet the standards? And they're just there to do the best they possibly can do. And training is a hard place, and it's where you learn. Training is learning, and you learn through failure and mistakes.
So you went back to the training establishment later on in your career as a major. And at that point, you were overseeing people who were in the position you were in previously, so platoon commanders. What had you developed in that time, and how had your awareness changed to the point that people were bringing you, I presume, the same kind of challenges? How did you coach them through that to change their approach?
Yeah, I absolutely see a reflection of myself in the platoon commanders that were bringing me issues with potential candidates for recoursing or backcoursing, and the evidence that they were trying to present to me to make a decision to select who was recoursing and who wasn't. And there were some really clear-cut examples where someone persistently failed an attitude test. And they're just not picking up the attitude and character traits that we expect in the military police to be high standards. But there are some things which are just skill-based or just a mistake. And where in the past maybe a mistake would have led to a back course or a recourse to recognize the severity of that mistake, it was trying to impart a degree of empathy. You know, these people are just trying to do the best they can, and mistakes will happen. In actual fact, the best learning occurs from those mistakes. But it doesn't mean we always have to recourse someone and do an entire phase of training again. And what we're actually doing in reality is delaying a warm body going to the field army and relieving the pressure on field army units that were suffering gaps in their workforce. And we were only exacerbating that problem by delaying people's entry into the field army. So yeah, I applied the lessons I'd learned over the course of the preceding 15 years or so to that appointment.
Were there any particular moments in your career where you developed that empathy? Maybe it was having people who weren't so understanding about you correcting your own mistakes.
Yes, I remember turning up to a unit as a junior captain, and I had an officer commanding who we clearly, from the very outset, had a personality clash. And whether our personalities were too similar or too different, I can't really nail it down, but we didn't get on. And I remember there being an instance where I think she'd asked me to support the brigade sports day, where it was a very simple task, just allocating teams to the different sports that the brigade were hosting that day on a sports day. And I'd done the majority of the task, which was, you know, relatively easy. And we got to the final few individuals where they hadn't been allocated to a team yet. They weren't super keen on football or rugby or anything else. So we had a tug of war team to create. And I remember the OC walked in at that point as I was allocating the troops to this task. And one of the members of the team mentioned that they felt that the team was too heavy and that there was a weight restriction for the tug of war. And it was just a really minor piece of detail that I just hadn't clocked, but was happy to receive that information from the members of the team. And it was like the OC felt that I'd failed that task in its entirety because I wasn't, I guess, meticulous enough in my understanding of the problem or the detail behind what she'd asked me to do. And rather than addressing it with me immediately, what actually occurred was she blanked me for 2 to 3 weeks because of what she felt was a performance-related issue. Now, I respond better to being told what the standard is. If I've made a mistake, I'd rather know about it so I can then address it again in the future. And she didn't allow me that opportunity. And from that point onwards, our relationship really did snowball out of control. And we didn't really get on for the rest of my time. And I definitely felt that there was a degree of having my character destroyed at a personal and professional level. And I can remember coming away from that situation feeling that I would never do that to anyone else. And I think that's where, if you've gone through those hardships and gone through being made to feel like that, you understand a degree of empathy when other people are subject to it. And I think that's really important to understand. And we learn a lot from those hard times. And I think that was one of those watershed moments for me, whereby I understood the feeling of being made to feel so small and belittled, and that I would never do that to anyone else.
So through that, you had a bad example of leadership and effectively were able to evaluate that leadership style. And then through that, develop your own leadership style going forwards. Did you have any other experiences in that time, maybe in command, maybe in staff, where you felt your leadership developed?
Yeah, after that, I was really lucky to get a job in the Permanent Joint Headquarters, which is the UK's operational headquarters based in Northwood near Watford. And it looks after all overseas operations and all troops deployed in overseas operations. And I was looking after all of the African operations, Middle East operations, and counterterrorism operations. And during that time, I got to travel so widely. I deployed to Mali, Libya, Djibouti, Uganda, Somalia, DR Congo, North and South Sudan, Bosnia, Afghanistan, Cyprus, and lots of the Middle East as well. And during that time, not only was I exposed to things like multinational operations, but then you pick up the culture of different armies and you pick up the social differences between how they operate. But you also get to meet the locals and see how, you know, travel really expands your mindset in terms of cultural appreciation. And I also came across our troops that were in really isolated locations. And they had really unique problems. So to try and provide a similar provision and ensure people's welfare is looked after, you have to come up with really novel solutions. Again, it developed a level of emotional intelligence, I guess, that everyone's situation is different. And you need to appreciate people in the situation they find themselves in and get to know those people and what it is they're asking for. And then you can apply a level of equity and parity across the board to try and make sure that you do the right thing by everybody, but you must recognize the individual and unique differences at an individual level.
Can you give me a specific example of that time which demonstrates what you're talking about?
We had a boss at the time, so it was a brigadier, a major general he retired as, Brigadier Duncan Capps. And he used to walk by people's desks and spend 2 or 3 minutes just talking to everybody. And he would really get to know you as an individual. And you didn't really notice it at the time and what he was doing. He would talk to you for 2 or 3 minutes and then move to the next desk and the next desk, all before he got to his office. And for me and him, we shared a common interest in kayaking. So he'd spend 5 minutes talking about how my training was going and tell me how his training was going. And it really developed that human connection. And what I recognized at the time is when he would then come back to me at points of high tempo and when we really needed to get the work done, I was far more happy to work with him because we had that human relationship. And it just goes to show the value of just that human connection and knowing your people.
You then went on to work for the United Nations Peacekeeping Force in Cyprus. What lessons did you take from your time as Deputy Commandant at the training establishment and your time at Permanent Joint Headquarters that was useful for your work with the UN in Cyprus?
Yeah, I had a really fortunate position that I was assigned to Cyprus as the Force Protection Unit Officer Commanding, which I didn't really fully understand at the time. But when I got there, it was a multinational unit. And as a Brit, I had command over that unit. And our unit comprised of Brits, Hungarians, my 2IC was a Hungarian, Slovaks, Serbians, and quite uniquely for a Brit in command, it had a platoon of Argentinians. So that brought quite a unique command and leadership dynamic. And when I arrived, I noticed very quickly there was a divide in the unit. The unit existed to deliver two functions. The first one was the Force Military Police Platoon, which was there to police the UN force. So these weren't people patrolling the buffer zone and doing the UN's work. These were actually policing the force. And then I also had the Argentinian Security Platoon, who provided garrison security to the UN base and the main base location. And when I arrived, the Security Platoon had only recently been moved across under the command of the Force Protection Unit. And there was a really clear and evident divide between the two elements. There was a spotlight on the 4th Military Police Unit. That's how the unit was commonly referred to. The security platoon were this kind of ugly stepsister of the unit, and it manifested in interpersonal issues between the two platoons. It meant that the Argentinians weren't comfortable socializing with the military police platoon, and that was really playing out in our operational effectiveness. The unit wasn't performing as optimally as it could have done. So yeah, that was quite a unique leadership challenge to walk into, and then to be able to apply the lessons I'd learned to that situation. And I felt it was a real opportunity. And yeah, it was a blank canvas to kind of work with.
So you identified the problem, which was this divide. How did you go about fixing it?
So one of the real issues I identified quite early on was that the Argentinian platoon would circumvent the unit's chain of command, and they would refer issues and problems to the Argentinian chain of command from a national perspective. And what it meant was, quite early on during the first month I was there, the commander of the Argentinian National Force would phone me and say, I've heard this is occurring in your unit. Can we talk about it? Because there seems to be an issue, of which I was just completely unaware of. And from a command and leadership perspective, that is quite professionally embarrassing to not know what's going on in your unit. And that really exemplified the operational divide. Maybe they just didn't trust me. So I then set up section level meetings. So I made sure that I was in a room with each section on a routine basis.
So there's three sections in a platoon. So every 3 weeks you'd see these people.
Yes, more or less. And then I had the other platoon as well, the military police platoon. But on a relatively regular basis, I would have direct contact with the sections and make time for them to tell me what their issues were. And as you can imagine, with the Argentinian platoon, it was quite closed ranks. Whereas conversely, with the military police platoon, the Brits were more than happy to tell me what their issues were on a weekly basis. But with the Argentinians, yeah, I don't think we had that level of trust because I hadn't spent a lot of time with them. So it was a chink in the armor quite early on. I think they mentioned something about how their accommodation wasn't particularly great. And there wasn't much else spoken about during the first month I was there. And I asked the section commander and the platoon commander to walk me around their accommodation to see what they were talking about. And yeah, you wouldn't put animals in some of the accommodation these individuals had to live in. It was completely unacceptable. So I made it my mission for the first month to do everything I possibly could do to fix that accommodation problem. I brought the force commander down, who thought it was completely unacceptable, and she directed the force engineers to refurbish all of their accommodation. And by the end of that refurbishment phase, they probably had the best accommodation in the entire mission. But what that did is that built the trust that they would tell me a problem, I would action that problem and get back and solve it for them. And from that point onwards, they opened up to me, and we then had the opportunity to talk about this divide that existed. And I very quickly realized that it was one of identity. They didn't feel part of the unit. So I made it my mission to deliver an entire unit intent, you know, what my leadership philosophy was, and that was one based on mutual trust, professionalism, and being one team, which I think, you know, connects with a lot of people.
How did you set about creating this one team dynamic? It's one thing saying it and telling everyone you want to be one team. What actions did you take that made that more likely?
So the first thing I did was rebrand. So the unit had a logo that had been developed, and we rebranded and really focused on this logo was for the whole unit. And I requested that the security platoon dropped their logo for their platoon. And we incorporated elements of their logo and elements of our logo into this singular logo. Another, like, it doesn't seem big at the time, but our social club, so the unit social facility, was named the International Military Police Club. Well, actually, that's only half of the unit. So we renamed it the Force Protection Club. And then I allocated some money to both platoons so that the military police platoon could refurbish the inside and the Argentinian security platoon could own and refurbish the outside. And I gave them autonomy and freedom to be able to make that what they wanted. And you know, there's nothing more that an Argentinian loves than an asado. So they spent that money on creating a barbecue that they could put half a cow on every week, which was great. So we had this grand opening ceremony and they really took ownership of that and it became their space as well. So yeah, things like that, creating a common discipline policy, creating a common leave policy so things weren't applied in different ways, fixing accommodation up to a similar standard, you know, that really then had a lot of benefits.
So that's great that you've built that team cohesion, but what were the operational benefits of it?
Well, I guess what we had was a lot of pride in the unit. I can remember the unit line, so our technical accommodations, our offices, they weren't in very good condition. So on a Friday afternoon for about 3 months, I asked my command team to come in scruffs and we were redecorating. So I painted my office and I would repaint the toilet. I would replaster it and my command team would do the same. And you'd have people walking past. So the Argentinians just don't get that level of exposure to their commanders. They would never do something like that. It's quite an authoritative dynamic they have with their leaders and commanders. So they would walk past and they would be taking pictures of me, crouched down behind the urinals, replastering and repainting stuff, because it was highly novel for them. But what I learned was by leading by example, you know, that quickly spread. And they then started to come in and started to repaint their offices. And it was just one of those small actions that by creating pride in your unit, then develop that cohesion. I also took the action of putting an Argentinian member of the security platoon, one that could read English and write English particularly well, within the military police platoons, because we didn't have a Spanish-speaking capability within the force military police. So I integrated the two platoons together and they worked operationally together, which was great for me because it gave us a Spanish-speaking capability. And it was great to break down the barriers because they were working together more closely. Again, that spread because you would then have the Brit section commanders providing language training and supporting the development of those individuals on a personal level. And they took it on themselves to put that into place, which was great to be able to see. And that then started playing out because we would then complete tasks a lot quicker. I wouldn't have to wait for Spanish translations because we could do them directly in the platoon. There was a 6-monthly military skills competition. It was unheard of for the Force Protection Unit to win it because we were such a minor unit compared to the larger nations there. And I gave time to the team that was made up of all of those nations and the Argentinians together to have time off to train. And they really developed a cohesive team. And we went on to win that competition. You know, it'd been going for 30 years and we hadn't won it for a long time. And we went on to win again and again and again. And I know they're still winning that competition today. We've honed that training package to such an extent that they continue to win to the point where I think they're actually having to change the competition because we're winning so often. So it was really great to then see that playing out in cohesion, but in our operational effect.
You've talked a lot about the integration of the Argentinian platoon there. How did you work with the Hungarian, Serbian, Slovak and other forces? And what did that give you?
So my second in command was a Hungarian and she was exceptional. I couldn't have asked for a better 2IC. And what it allowed me to do was connect with the nations at a command level because I had senior NCOs in each of those nationalities that formed part of the unit. And I would bring them in as part of the command team. So everyone had a seat around the command table from their national perspective and everyone had a voice at the table. And it was really good because then you get buy-in and you have influence within those nations because you've brought their members of their team into your command environment. So that leveraged influence where I needed to be able to resolve a personal issue, for example. If there was interpersonal issues, we could quickly get them resolved because I had the trust of the command team.
Did you learn anything through that, such as policing techniques or specific skills?
Yeah, absolutely. There is an arrogance to be said with the Brits that we think we know the best way all the time and that we always have the best solutions. And that was not the case at all. We had Hungarians and Serbians and Slovaks that were highly proficient in skills that we didn't bring. Like there was an individual who'd done 25 years in road traffic collisions and he was an absolute subject matter expert. That skill set didn't exist elsewhere in the platoon. So that allowed us to then use those skills in a way and use people's strengths and weaknesses to benefit the outcome of those sections. So yes, they were a senior NCO from a different nation, but you use them for their particular skill set. And what I learned from that was when you engage with people on a real human level, you can really break down the cultural barriers that exist because there are obvious cultural and social differences between nations, but things like servant leadership, leading by example, empowerment, understanding your people and their problems at a personal level, it generally transcends those cultural and social barriers. And that's what really enabled me to have a cohesive team at the end of it by taking a real human approach to leadership.
You're now at the Center for Army Leadership. How have all these lessons of leadership that you've learned over that time affected what you do here? And how are you trying to implement it?
It's been a real eye-opener to be professionally obliged to think about leadership every single day. And firstly, I recognize that my leadership journey to date has been a bit of a muddle. And I guess most people's leadership journeys are a bit of a muddle. And we recognize that as a center. We recognize that maybe the army hasn't got the most optimal way of developing its leaders. In fact, the army did a review in 2015, and that was the outcome. That was the summary, that the army isn't developing its leaders as effectively as it could do. And we're working towards a strategy at the moment which seeks to improve that. And one of the big things that we've done recently is we've mapped out for the very first time, based on the science of leadership, and it's taken about 7 years to get to this level of understanding, all of the skills and competencies required of a great leader. And we've now written those down. And that forms the making of a framework that the army can then rewrite its courses and develop its training, both in formalized training and outside of formalized training. But unless we understand that, we can't hope to improve our leadership journeys of everyone. Everyone has the capacity to lead. We just need to eke that out of everybody.
Well, I've had a sneak peek of the competency framework, and it is brilliant. If I'd have had that when I was going through my basic training, to turn things that are concepts or arts and thinking, these are the specific outcomes I need to deliver in order to improve my leadership.
Leadership isn't easy because you have to find a balance between command, leadership, and management. And they are three distinct but complementary skills. So command is the authority vested in an individual to direct orders and essentially demand, because we have service law, that things are carried out in a certain way. Management is the right processes to get you to that end state, to make sure that we do that in a safe and compliant way. But leadership turns command and management on its head. Leadership is about the leader supporting everyone immediately below you and enabling them to support everyone below them. So it puts these two diametrically opposed models. You know, one is downward facing in terms of orders and command, and one is upward facing in terms of support. And you have to try and overlay that. And I think earlier on in our careers, as junior commanders or junior leaders, we're quite task focused and we're quite command focused, which drives a task focused climate. And the one that really enhances your human performance, so the human interactions you have with people and, you know, the human advantage, the name of this podcast, is about having that human connection with people. And that really comes with experience and it comes over time. And we shouldn't rush leadership and we should recognize that we need to look inwardly. Being self-aware is a great skill to have as a leader, but it comes with time and experience and an honest feedback from others around you and seeking that honest feedback.
We like to finish the human advantage with three quickfire questions. So first of all, what do you like to do to relax?
I am an outdoors person, so I definitely like to climb mountains. Putting one foot in front of the other, I find quite cathartic. And I like to do DIY. So yeah, getting into the garage, doing a bit of woodworking, put my creative side of my brain to use.
Fantastic. What books, movies, or people have you learned important lessons about leadership from?
Probably the biggest impact that a book or podcast has made on me recently was The Coaching Habit by Michael Bungay-Stainer, which talks you through the uses of the four core skills of coaching and puts that into a strategy for you. And it's really had an impact in how I treat people and talk to them and communicate with them on a daily basis.
And what would you say to Second Lieutenant Love at the beginning of his leadership career, based on what you know now?
Probably slow down. You don't have to rush to get to the next rank, get to the next job, and focus on the people along the way. You will always remember the human connection you've had with those around you, those above you, below you, and your peers. And those are highly valuable experiences. And if you rush those, you know, you'll lose those good learning opportunities.
Major David Love of the Centre for Army Leadership, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ash.
I was very grateful to Major David Love for giving me his time today. He's at the Centre for Army Leadership, putting these ideas about leadership into practice and into tools that the rest of the Army can use. There were a few key themes that really came out to me. The first was about understanding your people. That's a phrase people use a lot, but what was great to hear from Dave was about how he did that. His example from his time in Cyprus was sitting down with platoons as sections so that he could understand them as individuals and give them the chance to air their concerns and their problems and their grievances directly to him. Importantly,
He then solved those problems. He learned about empowerment from his time at Permanent Joint Headquarters and how fixing people's problems makes their performance much better. And he then carried that on in Cyprus and ended up with a very inclusive team that was able to deliver operationally at a much higher standard by drawing on the individual capabilities of that very diverse team. He also understands cohesion and how to build that, firstly through that practice of talking to the people within his team, but also by building unit identity, by collaborative work in redecorating the headquarters, by changing the unit badge, which he even ended up putting on mugs that he gave out to everybody within the unit. Underpinning all of that was an understanding of empathy, first through reflecting on the leadership of someone who'd led him badly, and then being able to evaluate that and consider how he would lead when he was given that responsibility. This was an episode of The Human Advantage from the Centre for Army Leadership. It was produced and presented by Ash Bardwaj of Digital Dandy and co-produced and mixed by Hannah Varrell. What you hear on each episode are the views of the participants and do not represent the position of the Centre for Army Leadership, the British Army, or the UK government. Please rate and subscribe to The Human Advantage on your podcast app, where you can find more episodes. If you enjoyed the episode, do send it to any friends and colleagues that you think might appreciate it, and maybe even share it on social media. For more information about developing leadership, just search online for the Centre for Army Leadership. Thanks for listening.